simple question is, well, what is the theory of racial capitalism? Now, in its most casual usage, racial capitalism is a term that is used to describe the idea that racism and capitalism cannot be separated. Now, whereas more mainstream and liberal approaches tend to see racism as stemming from ideas and interpersonal interactions, racial capitalism is a phrase that's taken to mean that racism is structural, institutional, and that it has economic dimensions. So racist policing, mass incarceration, the disparities in black and white wealth, education and healthcare, all of these are taken to be examples of racial capitalism. So on the surface, then, the theory can seem to be consistent with Marxism and a Marxist approach to understanding race and racism. However, while the term is increasingly being used as a shorthand to refer to structural racism, not everyone who uses the term racial capitalism necessarily implies a particular analysis by it. But the phrase itself, however, I would argue, is underpinned by a more substantial set of politics. So the phrase itself, I think if you use it, it necessarily points to, I think, a really crucial question on which it and Marxism begin to diverge sharply. And that question is, why are racism and capitalism inseparable? While Marxism argues that racism is a product of capitalism and a tool used by the ruling class to maintain its power and wealth, the theory of racial capitalism argues that capitalism is inherently racist because it developed in Europe, and thus it's shaped along pre-existing racial and nationalistic prejudices that permeated European society. While Marxism argues that it is primarily capitalism that shapes racism, the theory of racial capitalism argues that it is racism that shapes capitalism. Now, these crucial differences on what can seem like a purely historical question has significant implications for anti-racist and indeed anti-capitalist strategy. Cedric Robinson, who popularized and developed this theory in his 1983 book Black Marxism, made explicit the key strategic implications of these ideas. Firstly, that the inheritance of racism from European civilization explains the endemic racism amongst the European and US working class. Secondly, the prevalence of racism and nationalism amongst workers disproves Marx's claim that the working class is capable of being a revolutionary class. And finally, that the origins of Marxism in Europe makes it subject to the same prejudices of European society, thus making it incapable of being a revolutionary theory and thus a strategy for liberation. Now, racial capitalism as a theory doesn't just represent a historical disagreement with Marxism. It's a rejection of its most fundamental arguments, that the international working class is capable of the overthrow of capitalism and the liberation of every oppressed group within it. Now, when you consider what the theory proposes, it then starts to explain why both the phrase racial capitalism and the underlying theory are increasingly popular. I think there's a bunch of different aspects to this. Firstly, it fits with the generally accepted mainstream liberal understanding of racial divisions as something that is inherent and cannot be the product of capitalism because they predate it. After the civil rights movement, it's a recognition of the economic and structural aspects of racism that remain even when supposed legal equality has been won. After the global financial crisis, it fits with the economic reality of racism in the United States and the deepening economic inequality itself. It fits with the day-to-day experience of racism, where those who are racially oppressed find themselves in conflict with both state institutions, like the police and prisons, as well as economic pressures. And it appears to carve out a space between both economic reductionism and liberal identity politics. And I think most crucially, it fits with the historical weakness of the US working class, including the deeply entrenched racism in US society. And it also fits with the liberal politics of academia. It provides a more radical sounding critique of racism and capitalism while accepting the underlying elitist, anti-working class and anti-Marxist tendencies of the academy. The seriousness of the need to struggle against both racism and capitalism demands that we be equally serious about the theories that guide us in the struggle. Racial capitalism is a term that has also gained popularity amongst Marxists, even though its underlying politics are hostile to Marxism. Attempting to paper over the differences between fundamentally counterposed theories is an unserious recipe for confusion in a situation that demands the utmost clarity. The theory of racial capitalism is wrong in both its historical arguments as well as its ultimate strategic rejection of the working class. Marxism is a set of politics capable of both providing an understanding of the relationship between racism and capitalism and a strategy for ending both. So this is a Marxist critique of racial capitalism. And before I begin, I want to make clear what Marxism is and isn't. Marxism is the theory and practice of working class revolution, a political tradition that sees oppression as essential to the functioning of capitalism and a key means by which the working class is dominated by the ruling class. Consequently, for Marxists, the struggle against oppression is an essential part of the struggle for working class self-emancipation, and it cannot be separated from it. Advocates for Robinson attempt to present any attempt to locate the struggle between classes as the central motor of history as class reductionism. Now, genuine class reductionists do exist, but I would argue are a deviation from Marxism and antithetical to this critique that starts from an urgent need to clarify and strengthen the interlinked struggles against racism, oppression, and capitalism. So I now want to go into what's behind Robinson's theory. Now, a number of critiques of Robinson's theory begins by exploring the flaws in its historical arguments. And I think by doing this, it presents a distorted view of what the theory actually is. Robinson's theory doesn't start from historical facts out of which a generalized worldview is constructed and then conclusions drawn. Rather, Robinson's starting point... Can you just click onto the presentation? There we go. Robinson's starting point, actually, is his central argument, that the working class must be rejected as a revolutionary agent. He then proceeds to construct his historical analysis as an explanation for that argument, and then finally arrives at his conclusion that the black radical tradition constitutes an alternative revolutionary agent, and this is actually how his entire book is structured. So to understand what's behind this theory, I think it's as important to talk about the context out of which it arose, as important as it is to talk about Robinson himself. And I think a central element of this context is the United States itself, where Robinson was born and spent most of his life. The centrality of slavery to the development of American capitalism, the centrality of racism in justifying it, and the essential function of racism in undermining working class unity has had a debilitating effect historically on the working class in the United States. Just as there have been periods of militancy and periods of retreat, so too have there been periods where labor organizations have taken better and worse positions on the questions of race. Throughout the history of the United States, racism has been a central question for the working class movement, and unfortunately, at times due to the intensity of racist ideas, at times due to the influence of the Democratic Party or conservative union officialdoms, this has been a question that hasn't always been gotten right, and the American working class has suffered for it. It's an important factor in the historical weakness in the union movement in America compared to the UK or even here in Australia. Yet, at the same time, a working class movement that has been relatively weak has existed alongside some of the most explosive and important anti-racist struggles in the world by African Americans. It is also contrasted with the inspiring international struggles, including national liberation struggles in the developing world. This contrast and the pervasive nature in pervasive nature of racism in U.S. society has meant that one of the questions receiving the most attention by anti-racists in the United States has been, why do working class people accept racist ideas? Now, some figures such as W.E.B. Du Bois and some of the earliest pioneers of privilege theory like Theodore Allen approached this question as crucial to rebuilding working class unity. However, later traditions, particularly following the downturn in struggle in the mid-1970s, saw this question as central to disproving the revolutionary character of the working class and Marxism. Now, this includes the popularization and development in academic circles of privilege theory, identity politics, whiteness theory, and internationally, this downturn in class struggle and the search for alternative revolutionary agents found their expression in theories that center students, the lumpen proletariat, and third world liberation struggles. Now, though Robinson himself was a student activist in the 1960s, as many critics note, by the early 70s, he had begun his shift into academia. And it's with this later tradition of academic anti-racist theory that he should be identified with. And this overall context then explains his starting point for the theory of racial capitalism. Black Marxism and the theory of racial capitalism within it were the products of a period of retreat of struggle, particularly in a country with a historically weak working class movement hamstrung by racism. I want to now take a look at the two key components of racial capitalism as a theory, beginning with the debate over whether racism shaped capitalism or whether capitalism created racism. Despite it being ancillary to Robinson's overall argument, I want to start here because it poses the first of two fundamental questions for any anti-racist theory. Can racism be ended? The answer to this question depends on what you identify as the source of racism. Now, Marxists contend that racism arose out of capitalism, and thus, if capitalism can be overthrown, racism can be eliminated. Robinson and the theory of racial capitalism, however, contend that racism originated in feudal Europe and that capitalism inherited a racist logic from its geographical and cultural origins. He writes, "As an enduring principle of European social order, the effects of racialism were bound to appear in the social expression of every strata of every European society, no matter the structures upon which they were formed." According to Robinson, as capitalism developed, it was shaped by the pre-existing racism of the society from which it emerged, and essentially argues that race replaces class as the main driving force of history. Now, if Robinson is correct in his arguments, there are a number of serious implications. Most importantly, if racism is rooted in European society, traditions, and cultures, and not in a particular form of class society, then racism cannot be ended by the overthrow of capitalism. It will persist so long as the descendants and ideas of European society exist. It is then theoretically possible to have a racial socialism, where economic structures are transformed, but racism could remain due to residual European culture. Such a society would then need to be struggled against again. So what we are essentially presented with is a dual systems theory of race and capitalism. But this points to a secondary implication, one that is suggested when Robinson's arguments are taken together with his justified celebration of national liberation struggles, that it is possible to have a capitalism that isn't racist if the domination of European or imperialist powers over colonized peoples can be overthrown. So when it comes to whether racism can be eliminated, whether racism is a European affliction or a capitalist tool of domination is an important distinction. Robinson argued that racism emerged in European society after the Dark Ages, originating in feudalism as part of the growing rivalries between Christendom and Islam. As part of his argument, he cites the presence of individual prejudices, linguistic differences, wars of conquest, and the presence of slavery during this era, often emphasizing a harsher approach taken by Christianity to these phenomena. Robinson also argues that capitalism did not constitute a revolutionary break from feudalism and more represented a smooth progression, thus carrying over ideas and racial prejudices from European society. Now, Robinson is completely wrong on a number of fronts. The first is his historical argument that racism predates capitalism. This argument is premised on a mischaracterization of what racism is in order to construct a dubious historical narrative that presents race as the driving force of history. Racism is a systematic form of oppression. It's not just about animosity and suspicion between different groups. Just noting that people look different, as even the ancient Egyptians did, or even having a prejudiced personal opinion towards them does not constitute racism, given that there is no political or social status that is institutionally ascribed to people's inherent features. Those who are racially oppressed are not just subjugated to individual or occasional prejudice, but encounter their oppression in the dominant institutions, structures, and ideologies of society. It's why anti-white racism is not a thing in the United States or Australia, but why anti-black and anti-Asian racism is. Racism is also about how institutions of power identify and oppress you based on political categories built around supposedly inherent difference. The forms of religious oppression and conflict between the rival empires of Christianity and Islam were not built around the idea of inherent differences between individuals, as conversion from one religion to another would change your status in society. There is no conversion out of political categories of race. War and slavery are also themselves not evidence of a racist logic. Even under capitalism, explanations that wars result from racial and civilizational differences are the domain of bourgeois pundits mystifying economic and geopolitical forces. Yeah. Contemporary myths and ideas about race can't simply be imposed onto feudal wars of territory and resources. It is a fact that oppression, war, and slavery existed prior to capitalism. It's an entirely different thing to argue, as Robinson does, that this constitutes, is motivated by, and is evidence of racism. Every class-divided society creates different forms of oppression by which a minority secures its domination and shapes society according to its interests. War and slavery are methods used by ruling classes to advance their own economic and geopolitical interests, which are then ideologically justified in different kinds of societies. Racism, a form of system of oppression that systematically targets groups based on supposedly inherent biological and cultural traits, did not exist prior to capitalism. Various forms of oppression and social divisions existed in preceding class societies, but none of them took on this particular character. So what changed under capitalism that created racism? Well, according to Robinson, not much. To argue historical continuity between feudalism and capitalist ideologies, Robinson contends that capitalism does not constitute a revolutionary break from feudalism. Instead, he argues that there was a relatively smooth continuation and evolution. This argument is largely premised on the gradual development of the productive forces of modern industry over hundreds of years prior to the Industrial Revolution. Robinson argues that they were accompanied by economic structures, forms of labor, and labor discipline that, in his words, would have already had to be of a character that would accommodate increased commodity production. Their formation was organically determined by the economic developments of previous centuries. Now, in counterposing his idealistic historical approach to Marx's method of historical materialism, Robinson misses the most crucial element of the transition from feudalism to capitalism, the transformation of the class structure of society, which then creates new institutions and ideologies in order to preserve it. While advances in the forces of production did take place over some time, feudal social relations ultimately became a fetter to their future development. These social relations would have to be completely overturned. A new class of commercial and industrial capitalists would have to eventually overthrow the old feudal aristocracies in order to become the new ruling class. The French Revolution doesn't quite fit with Robinson's picture of a gradual continuity. Commodity production and capitalist accumulation could not depend on feudal households producing their own subsistence and a surplus on their lords' lands. These would have to be supplanted by plantations, mines, and factories, requiring a mass labor force ripped from their lands, deprived of any way to survive, and forced by themselves, and brutally forced into bonded or wage labor. And this is how capitalism came into this world, dripping with blood and dirt. Capitalist society, ruled over by a new minority ruling class, dependent on a new mass laboring class, would require new instruments of rule, a new ideology of individual freedom and human nature, based on ideas of science and rationality, would have to replace religious ideas such as the divine right of kings to justify the rule of a new class of competing capitalists and individual property owners. The old feudal states would have to be replaced with capitalist state institutions such as parliaments, the courts, and the police to uphold the interests of private property against the new working class. Though some elements of the old society could find expression in the new, Robinson is wrong in his overall characterization of capitalism as just a more industrially advanced and socially sophisticated continuation of pre-capitalist forms. The different character of capitalist society is crucial to understanding the actual origins of racism. Racism emerged in North America as a product of slavery during the 17th and 18th centuries and the changing needs of the new North American ruling class. European colonies in the Americas were built on the cultivation of highly profitable commodities such as sugar, tobacco, and cotton. Cheap labor was crucial to this profitability, and the demand for it was initially supplied by unfree labor from Europe. Nell Irvin Painter points out the obvious logic of this. She says, for over more than a millennium, the vast story of Western slavery was primarily a white story. Geography, not race, ruled, and potential slaves, like vulnerable aliens anywhere, were nearby for the taking. Before the boom in African slavery during the 18th century, between one half and two thirds of all white immigration to the British colonies in the West, which constituted some 300,000 to 400,000 people, came as unfree laborers. Now, Robinson also recognizes this history, but ignores the problems that it raises for his narrative. He simply asserts a racial and white supremacist motivation behind the systematic enslavement of Africans without properly providing an explanation for the shift. The Trinidadian Marxist and historian Eric Williams and the historian Barbara Fields together provide a useful account of how racism did not drive slavery as Robinson contends, but instead developed out of it. The expansion and systematization of African slavery, which eventually saw over 12 million Africans brutally kidnapped and transported to plantations across the world, was driven by two key factors. The first reason, according to Williams, was economic, not racial. It had not to do with the color of the labor, but the cheapness of the labor. And it wasn't until the cost of procuring slaves from Africa fell below the cost of shipping over unfree labor from Europe that it became more systematic. The second factor was the limitations of unfree labor from Europe itself. These laborers were often on indentured contracts, and after 7 years, they were free to set themselves up on plots of land as rivals to the existing landowners. As plantations expanded, there was a further shortage of European labor and a rise in wages for free laborers. The ruling class in both North America and Europe also had to navigate the discontent amongst poorer whites in maintaining the requisite stability for capitalist production to take place. Fields summarized it as a historical moment when it became practical to buy slaves for life, at the same time difficult and dangerous to continue using Europeans as the main source of plantation labor. Now, in such a situation, the codification of racial differences in law became a way to protect the interests of the emerging ruling class. Black skin could be used as a way to legally brand slaves for life. Most crucially, legal racial distinctions were a way to sow divisions between black slaves and white laborers. The creation of large communities of poor blacks and whites with common experiences of subjugation, exploitation, and class oppression created the basis for multiracial revolts around better rations, better conditions, and the rights to property. Following one such incident, Bacon's Rebellion in 1676, the Virginian ruling class saw the need to break up this unity. And over the next few decades, laws were enacted in which the various superficial physical characteristics which we today associate with race were used for the first time to mark out all individuals of a particular group for different social treatment at a structural level. Now, these two developments were important for establishing significant material differences in the lives of blacks and whites, creating the basis for an ideology of race that could provide a distorted but plausible explanation for real-world conditions. Now, the development of racism was finally culminated with the American Revolution in 1776. The American Declaration of Independence reflected the ideology of the new capitalist class replacing the old feudal order, extolling the equality of individuals and their entitlement to freedom. Of course, the leaders of the American Revolution, now part of the new ruling class in society, had no intention of abolishing class rule, and American capitalism was dependent on black slave labor. Granting that same freedom to its slave population would be economically devastating. To reconcile this contradiction, it was argued that blacks in the United States constituted a separate race, which was inferior by nature and thus could be denied their basic rights and freedoms. According to Barbara Fields, the reason that such an ideology arose was simple. When self-evident laws of nature guarantee freedom, only equally self-evident laws of equally self-evident nature can account for their denial. Racism did not arise in pre-class societies because these societies made no pretense of being founded around equality. Their social hierarchies were plain to see and said that there was no need to account for such inequalities through the creation of a new ideology. Racism also only becomes necessary as a tool of divide and rule where a mass labor force exists with enough collective and industrial power that united action can overwhelm the existing repressive state. The ability for atomized peasants across the countryside to revolt paled in comparison to the existential threat posed by mass rebellion in the slave communities and working class cities that capitalism had now created. Now, understanding racism as a tool used by the capitalist class to preserve its own power and wealth is crucial to then understanding why racism under capitalism itself changes and is reshaped. For example, in much of the Western world, the targets of racism during times of war have shifted according to the main imperial rivals being faced by a particular national capitalist class. In the US and Australia this century, that has meant anti-Arab and anti-Muslim racism during the so-called War on Terror and the re-intensification of anti-Asian and anti-Chinese racism as imperialist tensions with China intensify. And another example of this is the shift from the more overtly racist white Australia policy in the 1970s to a policy of multiculturalism. This was to better accommodate Australian capitalism's greater need for migrant labour from Asia during the post-war boom. If racism is the primary force shaping capitalism, as Robinson suggests, it cannot account for moments in which the interests of capitalism require a shift away from particular forms of racism in favour of others. Precisely because racism is an essential tool of class domination under capitalism, it is also why it exists in non-European capitalist countries, including ones that have thrown off colonialism in struggles for national independence. The racist Hindu nationalism of the Modi government in India is one of the most stark examples of this. Now, when it comes to the ultimate question of whether or not racism can be ended, the theory of racial capitalism is vague at best, and its logical conclusions are pessimistic at worst. Marxists, starting from the premise that racism is the product of capitalism, argue that it can be ended if capitalism can be overthrown. So this brings us to the second key question facing anti-racists, and one I think that is the question that animates Robinson's arguments. Who is the revolutionary force that can transform society? Robinson points to the centrality of African struggle, both for national liberation and against racism in the West, but is overall vague about how and if ultimate liberation can be achieved. However, he is certain that the working class, which he presents as either European in nature or in origin, will not be the ones to achieve it. Attempting to explain the racism that disqualifies the working class from this historical role, he wrote, "As a class brought into being at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century by racial capitalism, to the extent that it had existed, the workers' collective consciousness remained a racial one, subject to the disciplining ideologies of the bourgeois class and responsive to what they had been led to believe was American culture." He agreed that the project of revolutionary change required reassessment and reconceptualization. Robinson's argument, in addition to being historically wrong, shallow, and mechanical, is also positioned as a corrective to a strawman version of Marxism. I would argue he presents a deliberately ungenerous distortion of the Marxist approach to race and racism. He ignores Marx's writings on struggles outside of Europe, including those of African slaves, and celebrating anti-colonial revolts in places such as India and China. Insinuating that Marxism is at its core has nothing to say about race, Robinson then characterizes black Marxists such as C.L.R. James as breaking from Marxism by writing about black struggle rather than continuing to the Marxist understanding of race. Robinson writes, Western Marxism has proven insufficiently radical to expose and root out the racialist order that contaminates its analytical and philosophical applications or to come to effective terms with the implications of its own class origins. As a result, it has been mistaken for something that it is not, a total theory of liberation. Robinson asserts that Marx and Marxism are both blind to the problems of racism amongst the working class and disinterested in the problems and struggles around race. And both these charges are wrong. Marxists do not idealize the working class, nor do we hinge its revolutionary potential on the working class being impervious to bourgeois ideas. Although it should be noted that the scale and intensity of racism amongst workers is often overstated amongst liberal and academic opinion. It is also the case that critics of the working class, Robinson included, do not differentiate between different opinions within the working class itself and backwards positions taken up by conservative trade union bureaucracies or social democratic parties. The vague liberal conceptions of class can also lump in sentiments of more reactionary sections of society, including small business owners and the long-term unemployed. Often these are all collapsed together as part of a tell-all exposé of working class backwardsness. Marx himself was well aware of both the problems of racism and nationalism amongst the working class and was clear that this was a barrier to its own self-emancipation. Writing about anti-Irish racism amongst English workers, he said, "In relation to the Irish worker, the English worker feels himself a member of the ruling nation and so turns himself into a tool of the aristocrats and capitalists of his country against Ireland, thus strengthening their domination over himself. This antagonism is the secret of the impotence of the English working class, despite its organization. It is the secret by which the capitalist class maintains its power, and that class is fully aware of it." It is precisely because Marxism concerns itself with the self-emancipation of the working class, a class held down by every form of oppression, that understanding and combating every oppression is crucial to the project of working class revolution. Marx summed this up when he wrote in Capital that labor cannot emancipate itself in the white skin where in the black it is branded. Marxism actually provides a clearer explanation than what Robinson offers for why it is that racist ideas can be taken up by the working class, including non-white workers. Firstly, racist ideas do not arise naturally within the working class, whether it's due to innate prejudices, as liberals argue, or whether it's due to supposedly European lineages, as Robinson argues. The ruling class, with its means of material and ideological production at its disposal, are able to mold society and its ideas to serve their interests through the various capitalist institutions such as the state, the education system, and the media. And these are institutions which working class people are alienated from and have no control over. Secondly, the lack of control workers experience in day-to-day life over their labor and their conditions of existence normalizes the acceptance of ideas and the dictates of those from above. Thirdly, the artificial scarcity created by capitalism, where workers are forced to compete against each other for the necessities of life, such as jobs, housing, and education, encourages the notion that other working class people are to be seen as rivals rather than as people with common interests. This, combined with the bombardment of racist ideas from the top of society, creates the basis for workers to accept racist ideas and hostilities. However, what makes Marxism a superior theory for understanding racism and strategizing to eliminate it is that it is capable of articulating not only why workers are capable of racism, but I think more crucially, why workers are capable of solidarity and self-transformation. That is something that no rival theory of racism, whether it's liberal identity politics, privilege theory, whiteness theory, or racial capitalism, is able to properly account for or coherently explain. These theories cannot properly account for why it is that the Black Lives Matter rebellions of 2020 garnered widespread multiracial support and solidarity. They cannot explain the breakdown of decades-long religious divisions during the 2019 uprisings in Lebanon, the 2011 revolutions in Egypt and Syria. They cannot explain why the Arab Spring inspired European anti-austerity struggles, workers in Wisconsin, or the Occupy movement, or the support for the Vietnamese National Liberation Front amongst the anti-war movements in the West, or really any anti-war movements in the West at all. Or union support for the Aboriginal rights struggle. Or the broader support by white Americans for the civil rights struggle. Or the support for national self-determination in opposition to anti-Semitism of the revolutionary Russian working class. Or the fact that the Haitian... Or the fact that the Haitian Revolution inspired the revolutionary masses in Paris who greeted its leaders as heroes. Now, why was any of this possible at all if the working class is irrevocably racist because of its supposedly European origins? In spite of how Robinson characterizes the working class, it is made up of people from every oppressed identity, racial background, and nationality. In fact, the majority of the working class today, internationally, those who have nothing but their ability to labor in order to survive, is non-white and non-European. So what is the basis for this multiracial class solidarity? First, whether conscious of it or not, this class shares a common experience of being exploited and oppressed as workers. This common experience of working alongside others of different races, religions, genders, and sexualities creates an organic basis for workers to identify with each other. Backwards and divisive ideas can be undermined when they come into conflict with workers' own day-to-day experiences of cooperation in the workplace. Now, this process is accelerated when a common experience of exploitation and oppression pushes them into struggle against a common class enemy. And I think the most dramatic example of this solidarity and transformation of ideas that we see today is the struggle going on right now in Myanmar. An organic solidarity has developed between the working class and the intensely oppressed Rohingya population in the course of struggling against a military dictatorship that is oppressing them both. These common struggles lay the basis for the workers' movement to identify with the struggles of the oppressed. Secondly, the working class has common interests. In the most immediate sense, workers have common interests in fighting for better wages and conditions. On a larger scale, workers have a common interest in overthrowing capitalism, taking control over the wealth it has created, and running society in its own interests. This objective interest exists whether or not workers are conscious of it or actively fighting for it. If this common interest can be realized and the working class is able to overthrow capitalism and overthrow the class that drives racism, abolish class divisions altogether, it is able to completely dismantle the material basis for the existence of racism and all oppression. Finally, the working class has a common source of power in its ability to collectively shut down production and restart it under its own control. And in doing so, it also has a common interest in combating every form of oppression that limits its capacity to struggle and exercise that collective power. So fighting racism is not some side concern or added extra for the working class. Whether workers are themselves racially oppressed or not, the class cannot truly realize its revolutionary potential until it fights for the demands and the liberation of every oppressed section within it as part of fighting for its own liberation. So the logic of working class struggle leads it in the direction of challenging oppression and transforming itself. The working class's collective interest and power is what gives it a revolutionary potential, a capacity for solidarity and transformation in struggle, and the ability to completely eliminate the roots of oppression. No other cross-section of society, even in its most mass and radical of struggles, is capable of doing this. Now, in rejecting the working class, Robinson centers the radical struggles of African people, something that he characterizes as an organic culture stemming from its accumulated historical experience of oppression. He argues, harbored in the African diaspora, there is a single historical identity that is in opposition to the systemic privations of racial capitalism. Ideologically, it cements pain to purpose, experience to expectation, consciousness to collective action. The resoluteness of the Black radical tradition advances as each generation assembles the data of its experience to an ideology of liberation. Now, the significance and explosiveness of Black struggle is undeniable, whether it's the anti-colonial struggles of Black, or whether it's the anti-colonial struggles or Black anti-racist struggles in the United States, or the leading role that Black workers have played historically in the United States working class struggle. However, Robinson's characterization misses a broader picture on a number of points. Firstly, that the potential for oppression to explode into radical struggle applies to every oppressed group. Whether it's the struggles of Black people, women, or LGBTI people, it is the experience of oppression that has led to the sort of struggle that has both seen significant gains for these groups and opened up the potential for solidarity and identification between struggles. But the same is also true of the working class as an oppressed group, including white workers oppressed on the basis of their class. Their oppression and exploitation can erupt into struggle and can link up with the struggles of other oppressed groups and raise the potential for liberation. There is a reciprocal relationship between anti-racist and working class struggles. Historical advances in the Black struggle have strengthened the broader working class struggle. And this was seen following the civil rights movement in struggles, in the struggles of public sector workers whose confidence in militancy was lifted by an influx of Black workers who had scored recent historic victories around civil rights and voting rights. And you can see that same phenomena today in how the 2020 Black Lives Matter rebellions have given confidence to the unionization attempts of Amazon workers. countries. The growing strength, organization, and solidarity of the workers' movement can also form a basis of social power to strengthen anti-racist struggles, and gains by the working class can elevate the conditions of its most oppressed sections. These struggles are intrinsically linked together, and it is unhelpful to counterpose black struggle to the struggles of the working class. The second problem with Robinson's conception of the relationship between oppression and struggle is that the experience of oppression is itself contradictory. Not all members of an oppressed group respond to their oppression in the same way. Passivity, accommodation, and conservatism can also be a response amongst oppressed people, particularly if they're from the middle or ruling classes who have something to gain from capitalism and something to lose from its overthrow. These same class divisions within oppressed groups lays the basis for solidarity between workers who are racially oppressed and the broader working class. Finally, the rejection of all non-African theories of history and oppression, while this is an understandable response to the marginalization and destruction of black culture, black thought, black history, and black agency, ultimately hurts the strategic clarity and theoretical capabilities of any serious struggle against oppression. Now, if I were to reject any theory that did not derive from the historical experience of the 60,000 Indians taken as indentured servants to Fiji, I would be cutting myself off from most of the writers on colonialism, slavery, imperialism, and capitalism. A serious understanding of global capitalism with a view to overthrowing it requires a perspective that goes beyond purely our own individual experiences and the experiences of only the oppressed groups that we belong to. We must take seriously the history of oppression and resistance to it everywhere, engage seriously with these theories that arise from them, and judge them based on the content and the strength of their arguments. Marxism is an attempt to take the historical and unfolding lessons of the working class struggle against oppression, colonialism, and exploitation internationally, and synthesize it into a fighting revolutionary tradition that doesn't counterpose these struggles, but attempts to articulate a strategy for their interlinked victory. Against their common root cause. And I think rejecting that entire tradition because its founders were born the same place that capitalism was is a disservice to our own theoretical development and the struggles that we seek to strengthen. So, to conclude, whether a theory is right or wrong matters because we want our struggles against oppression and capitalism to be victorious. Robinson's disillusioned and mechanical theory of racial capitalism is inadequate to the task of articulating a strategy for liberation. His arguments ultimately accept the premise that racism is the product of inescapable differences between civilizations or racial groups. It provides a historically and conceptually distorted picture of racism that fails to properly understand its presence amongst working class people and fails to propose any coherent solutions. We should be clear that the theory is an explicit rejection of Marxism and that despite its title, Black Marxism is an anti-Marxist text. Yeah. Robinson's ungenerous distortion of how Marxism understands race and class, his argument that race replaces class as a motor of history, and his rejection of the revolutionary potential of working class struggle makes it fundamentally incompatible with Marxism and ill-equipped to offer a solution to capitalism and racism. Marxism still offers the best alternative strategy, one that does not counterpose the struggles against racism and capitalism, is able to understand both, as well as the potential for solidarity and the working class's ability to transform itself and the world.